Warning, this week's Escape Pod contains graphic images of violence and real-life disasters. It's somewhat darker than our usual stories. If that's not your style, please come back again for something lighter next time.
Escape Pod 46. March 23rd, 2006. Today's story, Natural Order, by Michael Jasper.
Hello, I'm Steve Ely, and welcome again to Escape Pod. I'm fighting off a cold right now, so if this is your first time hearing us, take my word for it that my usual voice is a lot sexier. I mean, take my word for it, don't actually go and check or anything. Just a quick note on what everybody else is talking about this week, which is V for Vendetta. I'm not going to make this a full-on movie review. I liked it. It had flaws, but I thought it took real cojones to make that movie in the middle of this decade. What strikes me, though, is that everyone around me isn't talking about the movie for the movie's sake, but rather comparing it to the graphic novel and wondering what the original author, Alan Moore, would think. Well, Moore's a complicated guy, and he's got some passionate opinions about the big comic publishers and about Hollywood. He's publicly declared that he's not going to see the film, so what he thinks will probably remain a mystery. I read one essay, I'll post a link to it, that claimed the movie's thematic differences from the comic book amounted to a betrayal of Moore's vision. The author's position was that it's the job of an adaptation to preserve the original creator's message without changing any of it, and that by changing some of the messages in V for Vendetta, the Wachowski brothers were showing that they, quote, do not understand morality. In a later email message, he called them evil. Okay. First off, art's not moral or immoral. I said a few weeks ago here that I prefer original work to adaptations, but that's because most adaptations are stupid or shallow. This one wasn't, but even if it was, making a stupid movie isn't perpetrating evil, it's just perpetrating bad art. There's plenty of that in the world, and it's rarely hurt or killed anyone. The times I like adaptations are when the new artist has something to say. They have a passion for the story, or a criticism, or a new angle. That's why I like the Lord of the Rings movies. It's why I like Battlestar Galactica. Heck, I even like the Scooby-Doo movie, because the writers there were celebrating and making fun of their subject at the same time. The Wachowski brothers didn't make an Alan Moore movie. They took an Alan Moore idea, a very strong idea, and made their own movie from it with a strong but slightly different statement. For that, they have my respect. I'm even willing to forgive them for the second Matrix movie. The third one, they've still got some penance to do. And on to our story for today. It's a little more serious than our common fare. Here we have ancient ideas and original packaging, and a strong judgment about man versus nature. We present Natural Order by Michael Jasper. Mr. Jasper lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, where he's a technical writer and a recent father, and he's still writing, which makes him heroic. He's the author of dozens of short stories, and a frequent mention in all of the year's best anthologies. This particular story appears in Asimov's in June 2002, and is also in his first print collection, Gunning for the Buddha, available now from Prime Books. The story is read for us by Steve DuPont of the Obtuse Angle podcast. Steve's an accomplished writer himself, with some great essays on his site, and his podcast is the connoisseur's pick for a carefully edited freeform ranting about life, politics, and the state of the universe. Many podcasters can rant. Steve DuPont makes it an art form. So tape all your windows and get off the roads. It's story time.
Natural Order by Michael Jasper. They picked me up outside Wilmington, North Carolina, just before the rain began, but not before the gale force winds blew the cigarette out of my mouth. In the dark, I touched the fresh pack of Camels in my coat pocket with relief, feeling more tired than usual. But as long as I had my smokes and my ride, the wind and the rain didn't bother me. That was just my nature, in a matter of speaking. In the shotgun seat, Mrs. Thompson was bent double, her tiny black hand holding the seat forward at a sharp angle. I pushed my way into the back seat of the mint-green 1972 Monte Carlo. The interior light was dead. I could just make out Missy, a young girl with brownish-blonde dreadlocks, squirming impatiently behind the steering wheel and revving the car's big engine. I'd have to fix the light tomorrow on our way to the next job. The front seat dropped into place as I fell toward the back seat, but instead of the cool, welcoming bucket seat I was expecting, I landed on top of something hard and furry and muscular. Sudden barking filled my ears as yellowed teeth flashed in front of my face. "Down!" Mrs. Thompson shrieked, her voice carrying over the wind and rain. A coiled umbrella shot past me to hover an inch from the muzzle of the long-nosed dog glaring at me. Mrs. Thompson's black face was a perfect circle of pinched mouth and squinted eyes as she shook the umbrella tip at the dog. "Bob?" I wondered, trying to shift my exhausted body off the long-legged dog taking up most of the back seat. "Put that thing away," Missy shouted, swerving as the Monty hit water and hydroplaned. "You're going to put us all in the ditch, old lady." It wasn't Bob. The umbrella retreated, and I eased back onto the blanket-covered back seat. The thin, stretched-out-looking animal eyed me in the green light of the car's massive dashboard, and the smell of wet dog filled the car. Where the hell did they find another one, after all this time? Missy punched the accelerator, and the dog and I were both thrown back against the seat. The Monty flew up the on-ramp leading back onto I-40 just ahead of the storm. I was too tired to push the dog off me, fur in my face. It had been a while since I'd had to share my space in the back of the big old car. "Meet Walt Whitman," Mrs. Thompson said, trying to relight her pipe, the cheap red lighter. She'd left her window open again while I'd been working. The rain had drenched most of the right side of her, including her ancient carved pipe. The two entwined hands that formed the bowl of the pipe were dripping with tobacco-stained water. "He's our new flame." "Put up your window, T," I said, leaning forward to take the wet pipe and lighter from her gnarled fingers. My arms shook as I blew a puff of air onto the pipe, then lit the tobacco again with the cheap lighter. It caught on the first try. "I could have done that, show off," Mrs. Thompson said, winded from working the crank on the big passenger side window, looking as tired as I felt. She snatched the pipe from my hand and sucked on it greedily. After pulling out a rawhide chew toy wedged under my left butt cheek, I reached into my pocket for another cigarette. Next to me, Walt Whitman, the dog, kicked his legs once with a final growl and curled up into a surprisingly small ball. Only after my eyes had adjusted to the gloom did I see the numbers tattooed in each ear. I lit my Camel. "At least you got a racer," I said. "Did he win many?" "He's won his share down in Florida," Missy said. Her gaze remained glued to the road. Red lights flashed up ahead as we approached the evacuation roadblock. Wind shook the south side of the car, hurling droplets of rain against the windows. 22 wins this year alone," Mrs. Thompson said, pulling on her big glasses to peer at a rumpled sheet of paper. "Over 80 in his career, according to the bosses. He's our flame, all right. Our Walt Whitman is. He's..." Her voice dwindled away to a low buzzing for a few seconds. I opened my eyes and exhaled the smoke I'd been holding in. I must have blanked out for a while there, still recovering. Missy downshifted as she pulled onto the median of the interstate to avoid the state troopers, the mess of traffic-snarled cars attempting to leave the coast too late. I tried not to look at the panicked faces inside the cars, lit by the headlights of those behind them, all waiting to escape the storm. Just like us, but powerless to move, to phase, if needed, the way we did. Sucking on the cigarette, I slid lower onto the worn-out springs of the back seat. Slowly I pulled my gaze away from those we were leaving behind. One thing I learned from Oklahoma: if I thought about the people too much, I'd be worthless. The car bounced hard on its way up the other side of the median, the Monty's ancient shocks working overtime to compensate. My head hit the roof, and I glared at Missy, to no avail. Wind slammed the rear of the car as if trying to push us west faster. With an effort, I stroked the thin fur along the back of the dog next to me, only to evoke a low growl. "Dog's all skin and bones for shit's sake," I mumbled, just to keep myself conscious. "Don't talk bad about the dog," Mrs. Thompson said. "You could have at least talked to me about this," I said, blowing smoke toward the steering wheel. We had the empty eastbound lanes all to ourselves, with all the signs facing the wrong way. I blinked hard twice, barely able to keep my eyes open. "Consulted me, you know," I said, and passed out next to Walt Whitman. A day later, I was leading Walt Whitman on a jog around a 7-Eleven parking lot south of Davenport, Iowa. At the car, Missy filled the tank while Mrs. Thompson loaded up on Slim Jims and mineral water. A cool breeze growing stronger blew in from the northwest across a darkening sky. Two storms in as many days. El Nino and La Nina were tag-teaming our asses and had been for years. We'd driven all night, leaving behind Hurricane John on the Atlantic seaboard, pushing hard to make our next appointment. It was T's turn to shine, so she was loading up on carbs and lots of saturated fats. I'd forgotten to do that yesterday. I watched the way the fawn-colored greyhound trotted over the asphalt and concrete of the parking lot. He had his own loping grace, very little wasted movement as he padded around dusty pickups and idling 18-wheelers. Only his head bobbed side to side, his big eyes taking in everything around him with what looked like a shit-eating grin pasted onto his narrow snout as he puffed efficiently next to me. I was still beat from last night. We slowed, but I kept my eyes on him. Just as I was beginning to admire Walt's streamlined figure, he lifted a hind leg and aimed a stream of urine toward my boots. "Stupid dog," I muttered, stepping back and letting his leash out another foot. He proceeded to piss on his left front leg, then his right. Great. Couldn't wait to spend the next 2 days in the back seat with him and his piss-stained paws. Walt Whitman kept right on smiling up at me and whizzing away until a sharp whistle stopped him in midstream. Missy stood at the pumps, glaring at us while she whistled again. T was already buckled into the shotgun seat, tossing greasy wrappers on the dash as she ate. We took our time walking back to the Monty. "What are you two doing?" Missy said, voice spitting from her young lips like venom. She pulled at her faded Depeche Mode t-shirt. "Watering every fire hydrant in sight? Come on, let's go." "I needed to check his legs," I said. I dipped two paper towels into the water used for cleaning the windshields and rubbed both of Walt Whitman's front legs. When he's not pissing on them, that is. I want to make sure he's got what it takes. "Don't trust us," T shouted from inside the Monte Carlo. Her voice was thick with Slim Jims. "Don't think we've been at this long enough to know what we're doing." I watched Missy as I threw away the soggy paper towels. "He's no Robert Frost," I said. "I can see that already. Would you rather go back to us doing it on our own without a flame?" I shuddered before I could stop myself. Missy turned and slipped into the car, her slim body moving without a trace of awkwardness in her eternally teenaged body. "That's what I thought," she said, starting up the car. I felt a familiar pressure start to build in my ears as I led the dog around to T's side of the car. According to the Atlas, it looked like we'd be out in the country, far from too many people. Luckily, I thought, then caught myself. What we did was a necessary service, a balancing act with nature, really. It had nothing to do with luck. Walt and I slid in behind T, who was already beginning to hyperventilate. Her dancing slippers were now hidden by empty Avion bottles and Slim Jim wrappers. Wind whistled through her partially open window like the world's angriest flute solo. Missy's jaw was set in her typical way whenever she got word of the need for her skills. According to the boss's message on the radio, we weren't needed in L.A. until Friday. I wanted to remind Missy of that, but I bit my tongue. Ever since we lost Bob, she'd gotten tense about her work, as if she thought it was all her fault. But now wasn't the time or place, I thought, lighting up a cigarette, once we were safely away from the noxious fumes of the 7-Eleven. T was breathing deeply now, as if she were asleep. I patted Walt on the head, feeling the delicate bones of his skull under my hand. This was T's moment, and I wasn't going to let Missy ruin it for her. The first time I ever saw Mrs. Thompson dance, Robert Frost, Bob for short, had been alive, and I'd broken down into tears at the way she'd moved. Under a thick black sky, we raced south for another 2.5 miles, then parked outside a field far from any farmhouses. The late summer soybean plants rippled and shook like dancers on speed. A tractor roared past on the gravel road not 5 feet from the car. The tractor's driver hunched over the wheel with his gaze raised to the clouds massing overhead. I could see his fear, an animal fear. I fought the urge to hurry him out of the way of the approaching devastation, but we were not allowed to interfere in that way. Ever. Mrs. Thompson stood no more than 4.5 feet tall. Her face was usually hidden by an oversized pair of tinted blue glasses, yet she always managed to be looking at me over the tops of them. After touching the tight curls of her white hair, arranging them vainly in the drop-down mirror I'd attached to her visor, T turned and gave me a smile. "Don't cry this time, Zed baby," she said, handing me her glasses before she stepped out of the car. She walked to the edge of the field, slipped through the top and middle strands of the barbed wire fence, and began to turn slowly across the field of green. The wind twisted in time to her movements. Every step of her tiny white shoes took her a little bit higher into the air, her shawl opening around her like a parachute, until T looked like she was stepping from the tops of one soybean plant to the next. And so Mrs. Thompson spun across the field, calling to the wind, and black clouds dipped above her, forming a cone. In the back seat of the Monte Carlo, scratching behind Walt's ears, I sniffed and wiped my eyes again and again. She got me with it every damn time. Missy let me drive west while T slept. Since we had the time, I'd convinced Missy to let us take the long way to Southern California. Being in Iowa, despite the cushion of Missouri and Kansas between us, still felt too close to Oklahoma for my taste. In any case, getting closer to the coast and the air currents I knew best was an added relief. I went through a carton of unfiltered Camels along the way, stubbing out each smoke in our overflowing ashtray and immediately lighting another with the red lighter. T slept most of the way through Iowa, Nebraska, and into South Dakota. She'd been taking longer and longer to recover in the past few years. We were all paying the price for not finding a replacement for Robert Frost sooner. Though T didn't like to complain like Missy, I knew the added exertions were taking a toll on her. Tiring of the road on our way through the Badlands, I stopped the car at a scenic overlook close to Cedar Pass, watching a rain squall form against the backdrop of the setting sun. Something about the farmer and his tractor back in Iowa had been sticking in my mind the entire drive. I'd been worried about the man. Did he have a family? How would his crop survive? Did he have animals? Pets, even? And that was when I realized it, looking out at the reddish-tinted land, broken and pockmarked on either side of 240. I was going soft. Lost in my thoughts, I jumped when I heard a rustle not 2 feet away. Missy stepped up next to me, having slipped quietly out of the car to avoid waking T. I turned to look at her unsmiling face, then checked on Walt Whitman back in the car. If he got loose out here, we'd never catch him. But he sat obediently in the back seat, peeking through the Monty's tiny rear window and grinning mindlessly at the two of us. Missy prodded me in the ribs and held out her hand. "Keys," she said. "With pleasure," I said, and fished the key ring out of my jeans pocket along with the plastic lighter. I felt for the pack of Camels in my shirt pocket and offered her a smoke. I could smell the green hint of rain all these miles away. "What's your problem?" Missy said, ignoring the cigarette and grabbing the keys. The light of the setting sun softened the lines of her thin face. I looked away, trying to make like I was studying the hills behind her. The jagged landscape of misformed cliffs and mottled green trees stretched out to the west, melting into the pine forests of Roosevelt National Park and the stone majesty of Crazy Horse Monument. The rainstorm was breaking, forks of lightning cutting the air 10 miles to the west. "No problems," I said at last. "Why do you ask?" "Bullshit. Something's bugging you." She played with one of her dreads, unraveling it, then twisting it tight again. She poked me a second time. "Zed, how long have we been working together? 50 years? I inhaled on the cigarette and exhaled slowly, watching my breath take shape in cigarette smoke. I knew it was impossible, but I felt addicted to nicotine, or at least the act of smoking. And where there's smoke... "I lose track, Missy. From the moment I was picked, time sort of lost its shape for me." Missy let go of her hair and jangled the keys in her hand. The sound like tiny cymbals. "The boss has just sent our next job for after L.A. "When it rains, it pours," I said without thinking. "Sorry, just a little weather humor there for you. Hardy har har." Missy wasn't smiling. "We have to go to Wyoming next. Forest fire." I heard the storm approaching from the west. I never really learned before I started this job how to effectively hide my emotions. I could feel my eyes betraying me, showing my fear. "I guess then we'll have to find out if you and T made the right choice." "Damn it, Zed," Missy began, but I was already moving back to the Monte, heading for the back seat again. The rain would be upon us soon. Just an innocent, nearly windless shower. But I didn't want T to get wet again through her open window. And Walt Whitman was getting nervous with us gone for so long. Plus, we needed to get moving. We had a date with an earthquake in L.A., another city, much bigger than Oklahoma City. The way Robert Frost went was the way all of us will go, eventually. When too much energy converges in one place at the wrong time, it happens. When the forces of nature, beyond even the knowledge of the bosses, converge with too much strength or too quickly for us to react, shit happens. Shit also happens when some unforeseen human event forces its way, like a spike, into our carefully modulated work. I've gotten to know most of those in our line of work who are responsible for the other continents, and they all give us their sympathy. Here in North America, we've been getting too many of these unexpected calls lately. The most recent unforeseen human event took place in Oklahoma City. The reception on our radio had been particularly staticky that day of April. Calls had gone out, first for Bob's services, then for Missy's, then Bob again. All three of us agreed that the call for Missy must have been wrong. She really wasn't needed in this part of the country. We'd shared a quick, nervous laugh about that. Who'd ever heard of an earthquake in Oklahoma City? Before heading downtown to the Murrah Building by mid-morning. Bob had whined and scratched at the driver's seat on the way there before finally relaxing next to me with his rawhide chew toy. I almost did something about his whining. Almost. Which counts for exactly nothing now. Instead, I let him do his work, even though city work was the worst part of our jobs. I always forced myself not to think of the human cost, the deaths that resulted from what we did for the bosses, but this particular job, on this particular day, was all bad. Bob was a true greyhound, his fur the bluish-gray tint that gave his species their name. Slender and noble, he took off at 9:10, phasing like a natural, circling the federal building as he built the heat, the flame. He phased through pedestrians and cars effortlessly, just as we had trained him. Don't think about them, I told myself then. Think about the natural order of our world and how we helped maintain the balance. He'd begun to flicker with his flame when the first tremor hit. In sympathetic reaction, Missy convulsed in the front seat as the unforeseen explosion began, and I made my fatal error. I took my eyes off Bob to tend to Missy. The Monte Carlo automatically phased us out of the blast radius. But the rest of downtown Oklahoma City was shattered and on fire from the massive explosion deep inside the federal building. The fire wasn't Bob's fire. When Missy had pulled herself together after the man-made earthquake, I looked up. The Murrah Building was torn in half. Robert Frost was gone. All three of us phased in and out of the wreckage, moving past those we weren't allowed to help. Humans that I didn't even look at as I blew past trying to find our greyhound. T exhausted herself searching the catacombs beneath the building, while Missy beat her hands bloody trying to shake loose the foundation and uncover his whereabouts. They had both been looking in the wrong place. We who dispense with death and destruction forget too easily that we can also be destroyed. I realized the limitations of our abilities that day, and I realized the folly of our elemental powers when I found Bob 20 feet above me, impaled on a girder, his blue-gray fur singed black with his own unspent heat. We can be caught unawares by the evil that flows in the currents and tides and tremors of just one misguided human mind. We weren't as invulnerable as we'd thought. I woke from my nightmare memories of Oklahoma to the blessed silence of northern Wyoming. T was driving, squinting through the steering wheel at Highway 89, a 36-pound bag of dog food propping her up. She was singing an old gospel number softly as she barreled north toward Old Faithful, her forgotten pipe resting beside her. The chill waters of Shoshone Lake glistened like the distant waves I'd seen too briefly in Southern California. Missy slept in the back seat, Walt Whitman's back legs stretched onto her lap. Missy was no joke when it came to her work. Today's LA Times, now rolled up on the floor under my feet, had reported a magnitude of 6.5 on the Richter scale. Luckily, the quake happened at 3:30 a.m., and the buildings at the intersection of Highways 110 and 10 in southern L.A. were mostly empty. The sunken facade of the Staples Center and the bashed-in convention center next to it reminded me too much of the devastation in Oklahoma, though. Ever since the tornado in Iowa and my realization in the Badlands, I couldn't stand the thought of more lives lost, human or otherwise. The Greyhound in the back seat was a constant reminder of what we'd lost. I never asked to be reminded. And now, Walt Whitman was going to start earning his keep as our new flame. "T," I said as she ended her song, my hands quivering. I felt as if I'd been drinking cup after cup of coffee. "Mm-hmm," Mrs. Thompson said. She glanced at me over the tops of her big spectacles for a quick second, then returned her gaze to the road. She continued humming the same song she'd just finished singing. I paused for a moment, and then plowed forward. "Have you ever had any doubts about what we do?" I asked, afraid to look at her. I picked up her pipe and lit it with the red lighter, bitter tobacco and spices filling my nose. "Doubts," T laughed, taking the pipe from me. "I'm too old to have doubts about anything," said Baby. "What's there to doubt? We make the wind blow, we make the earth shake, we make the rains come. And now our puppy's gonna make the flames." She looked at me, her mouth a narrow line around her smoking pipe. "Just like Robert Frost did, just as good as him." "I know," I said, hearing the uncertainty in my own voice. But I wanted to say, "He's not Bob, and times are changing. Human nature was becoming stronger than our nature. The natural disasters we were responsible for paled in comparison to humanity's self-inflicted disasters. The polluted waters and acid rain, the acts of uncontrolled violence and rage, the dirty air, the bombings." "What if we made it stop?" I said, the words out of my mouth before I realized it. The big car swerved. "What?" Mrs. Thompson said with a sudden, surprising anger. "You want to make the bosses really mad? That it?" I shrugged at her and turned to the window. 1.5 minutes from now, if all went according to plan, a fire would be started somewhere up ahead in Yellowstone. Summer-dried trees would go up like oversized matches, and the fire could easily spread to the houses of people miles from where Walt Whitman would start his flame. And as soon as the land was burning, we'd be off to our next job. Maybe one of my hurricanes, maybe one of T's twisters. T parked the car 15 miles southeast of Old Faithful, next to a stand of 100-foot pines. I woke Missy and slipped the leash over Walt's narrow head. He leaped out of the car and tried to place his paws on my chest. While the fall breeze brought the scent of pines to my nose, I stepped away from him and fumbled for the comforting presence of a cigarette. The sky was unbearably blue. "Don't you worry," T said on our way out of the Monte. "Walt will do just fine." Missy followed us to a clearing in the shade of the tall trees, and the three of us gathered around the prancing dog. "Ready, rookie?" I said. Walt was pulling at his leash with anticipation, yet his smile was still there. "I hope you guys made the right choice," I said to Missy as I let Walt off the leash. By the time he'd taken 5 strides, he was at full speed, body curved and legs blurring. I could feel his heat already. He was a wonder to watch, I remember thinking to myself. He just may work out after all. Walt was phasing through trees, just as Missy and T had taught him, when I saw the 2 vans parked across the access road to the north. A campsite lay on the other side of the access road. A pair of men stood outside the vans, pacing nervously. I saw the automatic weapons an instant too late, as Walt's flame caught and the chaos began. I like to think that I would have been a brave person if I'd been allowed to grow up and live a normal human life. Maybe I'd have been a cop or a fireman like any other kid in the 50s wanted to be. Or maybe I'd be a lawyer and try to put away those people who ruined a good chunk of Yellowstone in their mad cause, whatever that cause had been. But at 19, my age when I was picked for this job, I would never have attempted to stand up to anyone if I'd still been human. It wasn't in my nature back then. Even now, after Yellowstone, I wouldn't call myself brave. Just angry enough to want to change an outcome or two, if it was within my grasp. We learned later that the men in the vans had been trying to send a message to the government for years. They had met at Yellowstone on their way to Cheyenne. Up until that day, their group hadn't been very good at what they were doing, and more of them were getting caught and sent to penitentiaries across the country. Some of them were apprehended the week before New Year's outside Seattle, while others were grabbed in a bar outside Bozeman, Montana, the truck full of TNT. The guys at Yellowstone had been a bit quicker than their partners. If they'd made it to Cheyenne that day, it would have been their third consecutive bombing. But on that day, they weren't quick enough to avoid the heat of Walt Whitman's flame. And so, after all these years, has it already been 50 years since I disappeared from my dorm room, smoking what would be my last true cigarette? I finally remembered on that afternoon in Wyoming how it felt to be afraid, to be angry, angry enough to do something against my nature. Walt lit the ring of trees just as the bosses had ordered him. He was fast and sure-footed, I gave him that, and fire followed him, lighting up the grass and trees in his wake like the tail of a comet. But Walt wasn't quick enough to avoid the explosion when his fire spread onto the brush next to the first van. As the driver stamped hopelessly at the flames, the first van blew like thunder, picking up Walt and sending a fireball across the access road toward the campgrounds. I felt the cigarette fall from my mouth. This wasn't part of the plan. L.A. had been hard enough, after we'd seen the security guards trapped inside the convention center when it crumbled. I couldn't sit around and watch any longer. So I called up rain clouds, thunder rolling across the sky. I knew I could use it to cover both Walt and the burning land around us with rain. But Missy and Mrs. Thompson stopped me before I could let loose the storm clouds. "Don't," Missy said. I could barely hear her over the explosion of the second van. "Don't throw off the balance." Walt was still running, fire licking at his legs as he struggled to keep his feet. He ran faster, but he wouldn't be able to outrun the unnatural fire roaring from the vans. He'd been too close. "Let me," I shouted. I could see people running wildly in the campground area until yellow fire separated us. "I can douse it with the rains," I wanted to say. "I can save them all, not just Walt, but everyone. The hell with the balance." T shook her head and hit me with a warning gust of wind that knocked me back into the Monte Carlo. She held me there with the wind, watching Walt and the surrounding countryside burn up, her face expressionless. I glared at Missy, needing her help. Walt Whitman streaked past us once again. The Greyhound was panicked, running in wide circles now, barely a step ahead of the chemical fire. "Look at him," I shouted to Missy as we phased in and out to protect ourselves from the heat. "Not again!" I struggled to lift my arm enough to gesture at the inferno taking over the campgrounds. "Not again," I repeated silently. Missy swung from side to side, taking in everything while T resolutely held me back. I could hear our dog yelping in pain. With the wind and the growing heat, I couldn't even scream. All I could smell was burning flesh and fur. Finally, when I was preparing to phase out and escape the fires, Missy made a fist and punched the ground. The tremor knocked T off her feet and sent me up and over the Monte Carlo. At last, in the shelter of the big car, I called down all the rain scheduled for the next month for the entire Pacific seaboard onto the inferno. The raindrops fell like millions of tiny bombs that covered the southwest corner of Yellowstone Park. As the rain tore into us and filled the world with a sizzling wetness, T turned to me, fear and rage covering her face. She gave me the longest look of my life, and I prepared myself for another blast of wind. But I held my ground and returned her gaze. I needed her to see that what we were doing was right. Thanks to humans, the natural order of our jobs had been destroyed, yet we could still do something about it. We had to. Otherwise, we were just as bad as the men in the vans. After what seemed like hours, T wiped rain from her tiny forehead and gave me the slightest of nods. I smiled at her and Missy and the wet dog limping our way, and I let the thunder roll across the mountains around us. The rain was cold and cleansing, reminding me that we had it in us to regain a sort of balance, in our own way. and the bosses were just going to have to accept that.
And that was our story. Sometimes you really want to know what happens the next day. You probably noticed we've gotten moving again on our reviews feature. Dr. Jonathan Sully Dog Sullivan isn't just a good reviewer with a bad Russian accent. He's our reviews editor. So if you've got a genre-related book, movie, game, or thing your aunt gave you that you don't know what it is that you'd like to review for us, you'll want to see our guidelines at escapepod.org and then contact him at reviews@escapepod.org. He is entirely in charge of the reviews, so don't ask me. And to celebrate my finally being able to put people in charge of things, here's one of the last of the book reviews we got before we switched over.
And this is Taylor Kent from the Snark Infested Waters podcast, and I've got a book review for you this week. I just finished reading The Ahriman Gate by Tom and Rita Horn, which is a Christian end-time sci-fi novel. Involves UFOs and transgenics and all kinds of cool technology set in a modern day setting. Very well written, very well done, not your typical Christian science fiction fare, much better than the normal stuff, and not another Left Behind debacle. So if you're interested in this subject at all, you're interested in kind of a cross between Frank Peretti and Tom Clancy, I'd say check it out. Very good book. Fact, as I do on my show with movies, I'd give it 5 out of 5 snark bites. Thanks.
Thanks, Taylor. If anyone missed it, that was Taylor Kent from the Snark Infested Waters podcast, which wins the award for coolest podcast name. Our featured listener today is Dan from Raleigh, North Carolina. Maybe he knows our author, Michael Jasper. Dan writes, and this is all a quote, "I am an undercover asset protection officer for a security company. That's just a really long way of saying I catch shoplifters. This job requires me to run after and body slam coked-up college students or guide meandering old gummers to jail. When I'm not doing this, though, there is a lot of walking around trying not to look extremely bored. That's where your podcast comes in." Thanks, Dan. All of us at Escape Pod are proud to do our part to defend America's retail merchandise. Seriously, very cool, and keep up the great work. Escape Pod is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. All other rights are reserved by our authors. Creative Commons lets us share this podcast worldwide without giving up all rights. Like the comic book, Bound by Law, from the Duke Law Center for the Study for the Public Domain. The comic teaches copyright and fair use by hurling a young documentary filmmaker into the epic struggle between them, with the occasional UFOs, monsters, and intellectual property zombies. It's a cool read. If my college had produced those sorts of texts, I probably would have made it to more morning classes. Our music, as always, is by permission of Daikaiju at daikaiju.org. Be loud. Be very loud. That was our show for this week. We leave you with this line from celebrity puppet author T. Barnabas Wig Wiggins, who said, "Give someone enough rope, and he'll burn it at both ends." We'll see you next week. Have fun.